No mai, whakaronga mai, ki te aotai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith.
In many places around the country, paddocks are boggy. We'll find out what's happening on the land shortly. But later, I'm indoors, drying off at an old carpet factory in Foxton, where high tech is taking strawberries to the next level.
Also in the program, Cosmos by a high country stream where young salmon are being encouraged to linger for a bit longer.
But first, it's asparagus season, and our guest this week is Horowhenua commercial grower Jeff Lewis, who's been harvesting the perennial crop since the 1970s.
There's been much more interest shown in the health of eating, you know, fresh vegetables, whether they are greens or whether they are root vegetables, right across the whole spectrum, leaf vegetables and asparaguses. Has ridden that wave as well. You know, broccoli became a very, very popular fresh vegetable. And so people are seeing fresh vegetables as a really important part of our diet these days. Not only is it scrummy and yummy, but it's also very good for us.
What is the life cycle of asparagus?
So asparagus is a most unusual vegetable. Most cauliflowers and lettuces and broccolis, you put a seed in the ground and a couple of months later, you are harvesting, you know, the crop from that seed production. But asparagus is what we call a perennial vegetable. So it's a plant that lives in the soil that lasts for maybe 12 to 15 years. And so it has an annual life cycle of growth and then dormancy. So in the springtime, when the soil warms up, the crown that sits under the soil, it becomes active and it starts putting up spears. And we harvest those spears for around about 100 days up until just before Christmas. And then we have to leave sufficient reserves in the plant to put more spears up. Those spears then turn into what we call fern, and fern allows the plant to regenerate through the process of photosynthesis. So the sunlight is captured by the fern and turned into carbohydrates, and then that allows the plant to regrow. So that regrows during the summer, and then come autumn, all of that fern goes brown, and we get our tractors out and we cut all the fern down, and then the plant becomes dormant, where it stays dormant until the following spring.
And when it's dormant, is there anything you need to do to nurture it?
It's not a gross feeder. It's not a hungry crop in terms of nutrients and fertilisers. So, you know, we apply the necessary fertilisers throughout the year. You know, we do soil tests and things like that to understand whether it's short of potassium or phosphates or magnesiums or whatever the plants in the soil testing program tells us. And we put nutrients on there. But it's not a hungry plant.
How do you harvest it?
We harvest by hand, so, you know, we've had around about 100 hectares. We haven't quite got that amount in the ground at the moment, but 100 hectares of asparagus on our family farm. So we've got about 6 kilometres of rows per hectare, so that gives us about 600 kilometres of rows, which when the plant is actively growing, we harvest by hand every day.
We're normally familiar with the green asparagus. Are there different types or different colours?
The green asparagus in New Zealand is by far the most common. For those areas in Europe, that like Germany and Holland, they grow a white asparagus. And a white asparagus is actually asparagus that's grown under the soil. And they'll as a spear emerges, maybe 1 centimetre, they'll dig down and dig a spear out that's in a very highly mounded row. And they will harvest that. Very delicate flavour. But all of those spears have to be peeled because there's that very high fibrous outer to it as well. So we don't really grow white asparagus in New Zealand, but we do grow some purple asparagus, and purple asparagus is a derivative of the green asparagus. The purple asparagus is really, really sweet, and that's often used like in a salad. So it's often used raw because if we cook purple asparagus, it turns into a khaki green, which isn't terribly attractive.
So speaking of cooking, what's your favourite way to eat it?
Many, many ways, because we eat it virtually every day. I'll have it in my sandwiches every day because I just absolutely love it. But one of my favourite ways is to take the thicker spears, buy some thicker spears, and I actually peel about halfway up with a very sharp peeler. And then I put that flat in either in a baking dish or and grill it in the oven or even in the pan with some olive oil and some fresh pepper and just caramelise it, you know, like you would onion or something like that. It just makes it really sweet. And it's a very dramatic looking vegetable, you know, so put it on a barbecue and caramelise it that way or in the oven. That's particularly nice and a little bit different than the normal steamed asparagus.
Are there other uses for asparagus as well as food?
Yeah, asparagus is seen as enabling sleep, actually, tremendously. So enables sort of relaxation and rest. And so there are some developments going on at the moment.
Can you tell me more about its alleged health benefits and how it's being developed here?
You know, asparagus is a very healthy vegetable. And so they are looking to develop a nutraceutical from the waste stream of asparagus and putting it into a pill form, as far as I understand. And, you know, hopefully we'll see that on the market over the next year or so as one of the benefits. But, you know, there's still nothing like eating it fresh anyway, because you're going to get that benefit just by eating it.
How would you describe the flavour?
Very much its own flavour. It doesn't taste like anything else. But, you know, I took a large dish to a dinner in Wellington last weekend, along with many, many other foods, and it just absolutely flew off the plate. It was just, the plate was gone before anything else was gone. So people just relished the fact that it was something new and fresh for the spring.
Asparagus, asparagus, there's something funny about asparagus. I can't quite sniff out what it is, oh no. Gee whiz, asparagus, asparagus, there's something funny about asparagus. I can't quite sniff out what it is, oh no. Gee whiz.
Horowhenua asparagus grower Jeff Lewis. Speaking there to Sally Wenley.
And now to our look at conditions on the land. In the far north, cows are being artificially inseminated. There's been lovely mild spring weather and grass is growing well. Some farmers are still feeding out supplements to ensure their cows are in peak condition for mating. News that Fonterra will pay dairy farmers a record $9.30 a kilogram of milk solids for the last season has them smiling. But our contact says it won't mean they splash out on new equipment or machinery. They're all too conscious of higher labour and fuel costs. 92 hectares of farmland near Kaitaia has been bought to convert into a solar panel farm, but building hasn't started yet. Small areas of new potatoes are being harvested around Pukekohe, which has had changeable weather this week. Due to the mild winter, iceberg lettuce heads are soft, and onion growers are digesting news that they will permanently lose access to a regularly used herbicide.
Prices are high for early blueberries grown in plastic tunnels near Hamilton. Meanwhile, blueberries and paddocks are coming into flower and will start to be harvested in a month or so. There's been mild weather and plenty of sun to help them along. The annual blueberry conference was held at Mystery Creek last week, and attendance was high as there's a steady expansion in the industry. Many growers are trying to organise harvesting crews in advance, fearing travellers will be lured to Australia to pick fruit rather than New Zealand. Many King Country farms are docking and beef farmers are calving in unpredictable weather, fine days followed by torrential rain. Some rivers and creeks are still pretty high, making lower paddocks a bit muddy, but those with more pumice-based land are doing fine. There haven't been hard frosts as is usual this time of the year, so grass growth is good, but they could do with more sun.
Taranaki dairy farmers are said to be at crunch point. They too need some sun to speed up pasture growth. Heavy rain is falling on a regular basis. Some are coming to the end of their supplement supplies and cow weights are lower than they would like. Some have started their breeding program already and others will start mating next month. One farmer says New Zealand has managed to successfully control the spread of M. bovis well and credits MPI, but acknowledges it can't be easy having to cull stock in an infected herd in Ashburton. In the Bay of Plenty, it's still wet and boggy around kiwifruit vines. Bud burst is a bit slower than usual, which is a relief for orchardists still trying to finish pruning. It's looking fabulous on the earlier gold variety, so growers are anticipating a good season. Avocados are being picked, and those which survived bad weather are selling well in New Zealand markets. The prices being paid in Australia and Asian countries are rather soft, as there's plenty of competition at this time of the year.
Around Fielding in Manawatū, locals are getting sick of having to wear their wet weather gear just about every day. There's been so much pasture damage from ongoing rain that more fodder and wheat crops will be put in instead of trying to revive what's left of the grass. But the wet is delaying planting, adding to the frustration. On a positive note, there haven't been any major storms and the temperature's reasonably mild, so lambing has had high survival rates. Paddocks are so muddy that stock agents haven't been able to get to some pastures or inspect stock. In the Horowhenua region, market gardeners have been planting crops this week while the sun is shining. Farmers are still feeding out on dairy farms, but with the milder weather and sprouting clover, that shouldn't need to continue every day for too much longer.
Across in Hawke's Bay, the ongoing rain and puggy conditions are making it difficult for those rearing calves. Many are being kept in the sheds to protect pastures, when usually at this time of the year they'd be galloping around paddocks. One farmer says it's just about as challenging as a drought trying to juggle stock, mud and ongoing rain. Down the coast in Wairarapa, winter sports are finishing. So locals in Wainui Oru held a quiz night in the local hall to get everyone together for a catch-up. Dotted in between days of rain, the sun is shining, but not quite keeping up with the amount of rain to sufficiently dry paddocks. Hoggets are lambing and older ewes have finished, so docking is underway. The condition of lambs this season is described as excellent. Fences are being maintained and helicopters have been used to get fertiliser onto hill country.
Kite Waipounamu, and weather at the top of the South Island is described as up and down as orchardists try to keep up with pruning amid bad weather and staff shortages. Adding to delays is the public holiday on Monday in honour of the late Queen Elizabeth. Apple and kiwi fruit are bursting into bud, even though some haven't even been pruned. Some orchardists around Motueka were in frost-fighting mode earlier in the week. Tests on gold and green kiwi fruit buds showed their flower potential looks good. Hop stringing is about to start, fingers crossed for sunny, dry weather, so the machinery can move among the vines without getting stuck. Bees are expected to be busy in fruit orchards next week as more buds burst into flower, particularly on apple trees. Tractors are running around the clock in Canterbury as they race to get paddocks prepared and sown into spring crops. A bit of sun on the plains is a relief after so much rain. Near Rolleston, a farm's underpass for cows is still unusable. The water table is so high it's like a creek. Paddocks continue to be so wet, helicopters are being used here too to apply fertiliser. Cows are being trained to know when to go to the milking shed thanks to a vibrating collar, which saves dairy workers the job of rounding them up. A dairy farmer says it's heartbreaking that cattle are having to be culled due to M. bovis, as in some cases stock are just about family members. Winter lambs are moving off farm to processors.
In Cromwell, nectarine and peach trees are blossoming fabulously, and the apples will start flowering next week. There have been a few minor frosts and the days have been warm with temperatures between 15 to 17 degrees. The soil has dried out nicely and orchards are not getting their vehicles and machinery stuck between the trees. In Southland, ewe scanning percentages are down about 10% and that's being attributed to this year's drought. Farmers are about two-thirds through lambing. Our contact reports a few sets of triplets and even a few quadruplets being born. Our contact says he's feeling relaxed and fit as he's been doing about 18,000 steps a day as he does his lambing beat. That's about 14 kilometres. Even though it's the busy time of the year, farmers are being encouraged to take the time to vote in the local body elections.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Matthew Kelty designed a system for growing microgreens inside city buildings back in 2017. This year, the company he co-founded, 26 Seasons, has branched out into strawberries. At an old industrial complex in a Horowhenua back road, they're growing sweet, juicy ones almost all year round. But as I discovered, it's as much about the technology being developed here than the fruit. I've just come to this very nondescript building here in Foxton, and behind the door looks like Matt Kelty. Hi.
Good morning, Sally. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Welcome to our secret laboratory located off State Highway 1 in the middle of Foxton.
It's an old warehouse by the look of things.
It is an old warehouse. It's part of a... the site is an old industrial building with infrastructure that used to dye carpets that, funny enough, is suited to do what we want to do, so that's why we're here.
It's a big space.
It is a big space. It's about 1,400 square metres.
And the low bluish lighting gives it a luminescent look, a kind of space-age feel.
It is, yep. There's some coloured lights. There was some music playing for the pickers, so it's almost like a nightclub hidden away in the middle of the day.
Shall we take a look?
Yep.
This is obviously not your normal strawberry patch. To start with, we have to go through a mesh curtain. It keeps some important beings with jobs to do from getting out.
Right, so we've already had a chat about a little bit of health and safety because we've got some bees that are floating around in amongst our strawberry plants doing some pollination.
And we're just going through a net here, which is separating the sort of admin area from all these racks and racks of strawberries.
Yeah.
The bees are especially brought in to pollinate the plants.
So they really enjoy themselves in here. So we've got a number of different pollinators that we're looking at and looking to use. And so we work with plant and food, looking at a few different options. There's a commercial operation that exists within New Zealand, and it's quite a common practice across the globe where you can bring in pollinators. So you can find out someone, get a box set down, and we just release them. They're in a little temporary hive, as it were, and they just do their thing.
Are they making honey as well?
Wake up in the morning. No, these ones don't do honey, but we're looking at getting the ones in that do honey. But it's really tricky, so they don't work in this environment under lights unless you kind of know what you're doing. So we've discovered the do's and don'ts of making it work.
Working out how to get the best yield, taste and shelf life, all without sunlight, soil or sprays, is a work in progress.
There's about 8,000 plants here, so I did a small trial last year that was 1,000 plants, and we learnt enough or made enough mistakes to be confident to scale up and go and make less mistakes and hopefully get some better looking plants. When you're doing anything such as taking a plant that should be grown in soil and outside and bringing it into a totally different environment, it's just everything's new, so we have to make sure that we get the, you know, create the right conditions, the right lights and what we're feeding it and for how long. So yeah.
So you're still kind of experimenting?
I think we'll be experimenting for the next 20 plus years, so it's going to be continuous learning, the same as any farmer outdoors who's running sheep or milking cows.
Instead of rows in the ground, these plants are arranged in racks, each lit from above, and they're sitting in a system of tubing from where they get their food.
The plants are grown in gullies, so it's grown in an NFT system, so that means it's nutrient film technique, and what that is we feed the plants a solution, and this solution continuously circulates, and so we recycle our water, and then we've got them under some lights, and then we've got the lights and the growing gullies and the plants laid one on top of one another. So we're currently three layers high, but our next iteration we're just building now is going to be five layers high.
Tell me about the lights, Matt.
I can't tell you too much because there's a lot of people playing in this space, but the lights are they come on and off at night. There's different spectrums to get the plants to do different things when we want the plant to change modes.
Mimicking the sun,
but maybe even slightly more efficient than the sun.
So you can't tell me anything more. Sounds so secret squirrel.
Yeah, well, look, I think it's there's a lot of investment that goes into something like this. It's high cost. We are producing berries that are being sold in the off season. So if we were trying to sell these in the middle of the spring and summer when traditional strawberries are grown, we just can't compete with the cost of production. So yeah.
Why grow strawberries in the off season?
Well, there is a really big demand for the fruit, and it's an existing market. We've just come back from Singapore. We were looking at doing a pilot over there as well, and I forget what the numbers are that they import on into a place like Singapore, but it's tens of millions of dollars worth of strawberries. So it's about creating a system that's as efficient as we can and creating a market opportunity, which it is.
The plan is to house up to 70,000 plants here, but the bigger plan is to export the technology, tapping into global concern about food security. Matt says they've had a lot of interest, not just from Singapore, but from Dubai and other places. Singapore, for instance, has little land for outdoor farming, but is aiming to have 30% of its food grown locally by 2030, much of it in large indoor vertical farms or on rooftops.
We'll probably export our growth system, so that's have our people and our technology and our racks. So a large part of this project isn't just about growing the plants. There's the technology platform and behind it, how we use our lights, how we monitor our nutrients and how we treat them and formulate. So there's I'd say it's probably about 40% growing plants and 60% applied technology.
They're developing a system which slides together to maximise space, important in places like Singapore, where the cost of real estate is very high. So what's happening at the moment, Matt?
So at the moment, we've got some pickers down there. So we currently pick every second day. So the pickers are going along and harvesting and putting the fruit straight into punnets, which then get weighed and sent off to a supermarket. So at the moment, because we're a lot of R&D, is that every rack that we have, the fruit is harvested and weighed. So there's a number of different treatments going on. There was three different varieties of strawberry plants here, and we're also looking at different ways of how we bring the runners in. So whether they're growing in a growing media or a rock wool, just so that we can have a faster pace of transition for those plants to go from a young vegetative plant and into a fruiting mode. So the shorter that we can make that period of time, the better.
So what have you discovered about the growing media so far?
It's complicated. So the first 90 days of a plant's life is the most important. We only have it for the last 30 of those days. So the first 60 days are with a propagator. So and how that propagator looks after the plant and sends it to us and pest and disease free is it, if it's not, it just has an impact over the fruiting season, which is massive. So that's a big focus for us at the moment.
This big indoor area may look just like a big warehouse, but it has its own ecosystem. There aren't only bees buzzing around, but other insects too.
You can see a small amount of bad bugs here, but the mm-hmm. good ones come along and eat those. And so I think we've got a praying mantis or two inside.
So they will just spread through the rows if need be, if there's stuff to get rid of?
That's correct, yep. So again, there's a provider here in New Zealand, Bioforce, I think it is, and we get a shipment that comes down sort of regularly and we release them. But it's all about trying to create a balanced ecosystem. So there's always going to be a certain amount of bad bugs here, but there's hopefully a good number of good bugs here as well eating the bad ones.
The plan is to significantly increase the yield off each plant compared to its outdoor grown cousin. By exactly how much, Matt's not telling.
So we're just standing next to some plants now in our growing system, and we can see there's not lots of nice and green leaf, and some of the plants have lots of flowers on them. We can see them developing into berries. Some of these plants have too many flowers, which means that they won't all ripen to the right size or the right quality. So one of our challenges here is growing the plant with enough vegetative mass so that all the flowers that come through, we can actually get to full and final fruit.
Do you go and pluck some of those off?
So as the pickers are going around, they're picking off the runners. There's a runner here, which is just part of the standard reproductive process that the plants do. So we pick those off. And any misshapen fruit that we have, we also pick those off at a young age. And any really small flowers that will never become a saleable piece of fruit, we also get rid of as well.
I can't.
Is a bee doing its thing there?
Oh, yes, there it is.
Yeah.
So the plants aren't sitting in soil, they're sitting in some kind of solution?
Yep, just a bit of solution with a few nutrients that's rolling through it.
So that's being fed through down from those pipes over there?
Yeah, yep, it continuously circulates. So here's these black feed tubes here. That puts the solution into the gully, goes all the way down the end into a drain and outside to the tank, where it's monitored with probes and fed with nutrients to replace the nutrients that the plants have taken up.
And what's the recipe for the solution?
Oh, yeah, I'll send it to you later on. We're really lucky in here because the environment that's created, the temperature and the humidity as a result of the building that we're in and the properties that are here make it a fantastic environment for growing. If a plant's growing outside and it's exposed to temperature fluctuations, humidity, rainfall events, you know, they're limited in their potential to reach their genetic potential. So what we're trying to do here is create some conditions that allow the plants to reach their genetic potential so we can maximise the amount of fruit grown.
The smell is beautiful, isn't it? Do you love the smell?
When I started, I could smell it when I came in the shed, but you get used to it after a while.
Instead of bending down and kneeling in the soil, these pickers are standing with trolleys by their side.
We currently have three pickers down here. They just live down at Foxham Beach and they come up here for a couple of hours a day or every second day at the moment. But once we scale up, we're not too sure how many staff we'll need. We'll need a lot more, but because it's all new and we don't quite know how it's going to work, we'll figure out it as we go along. It's really hard to get people at the moment, but look, we we think we've got a point of difference so that, you know, if you're a seasonal worker and you want to work in the winter and have your summer off, you can come and work in here, in this side indoors in the middle of the winter. It's nice and warm, music playing. We can also make it so that the harvesters or the pickers can come in at night time as well. So we can run our system where the lights are off in the middle of the day, where the power cost is high if we have them on at night. So it means that we could have people come in here at 8 to 10, or, you know, if they're night owls, those sorts of people.
Talking of the power costs, this must take a lot of energy.
It does, and again, that's why we need to achieve those higher yields and a higher sale price to make this whole thing work. But we are mindful of our footprint, so there's great environmental benefits in terms of farming this way. So we recycle our water. There's no nutrient loss or sediment that's involved, but obviously we use a lot of electricity. So we are looking at and likely to progress to solar energy on the roof. So there's a lot of roof here. So we're just looking at that option, and that'll hopefully, if we can tick off a few other performance hurdles, and we'll be straight into solar, because it's a rather significant investment with a long-term payback.
What was your background?
My background, I grew up on a farm out of Dannevirke and Paitua with my parents, and worked in agriculture, did a little bit of finance stuff, and then just started mucking around in a garage, trialling different things with the plants and lights. And growing microgreens, and sort of progressed to getting a scaled up version of what we're looking at now.
Strawberries. What is the potential of vertical farming?
It's an interesting question. I think everyone looks at New Zealand as having an unlimited land resource, but I think, you know, we probably farm in areas where maybe we shouldn't do. So I'm not saying that vertical farming or farming indoors, particularly in New Zealand, is going to be the complete solution or even mainstream, but it has to be part of our food security solution for sure.
Matt says they plan to supply strawberries through the shoulder seasons and the winter when outdoor farms can't do so.
It's not a threat to what they do, because it's an alternative growing season to them, supply season. And look, we hope that we can add some value to the strawberry industry by looking at some different genetics or different ways of doing things that we're, you know, more than happy to share.
And 26 Seasons is doing microgreens as well. You're doing strawberries now. What else have you got in the pipeline?
Yeah, so we've got an agreement with a breeder where we're going to be looking at different types of berries and berry crosses. So we are setting up a small laboratory down the rear of this building where we'll be running a whole lot of independent systems that allow us to try different plants in their own system and see whether or not they're suited to this type of growing. I think the key thing will be maintaining a growing infrastructure that's cost effective, cheap to run, and then finding plants that are suited rather than trying to force plants to grow in a situation where they're not intended.
There's the potential too to go one step further into the world of so-called smart foods.
Food that we're able to produce that has targeted nutrition levels or attributes that are properly suited to consumers or people with special requirements. So, you know, we use our lights in our growing system to manipulate the plant to do different things. So go through different growth stages, the vegetative and flowering and fruiting growth stage. But we'll also be looking at how we use our growing system and technology to alter the nutritional value and taste of the fruit. So it's a bit of a global theme at the moment as people look at alternative food production systems, ideally for health issues.
Well, as they say, the proof is in the pudding or the eating. And I couldn't very well not try one or two of these luscious indoor-grown berries.
So you can see that we've got a range of sizes here, but that just reflects the sort of trial nature of the system that we have at the moment and the different varieties and slightly different growth stages. But colour's fantastic.
Like a true strawberry? There's nothing different about that.
You should taste one. It's not an imitation one, so you should eat one.
Okay, here goes. Well, that is beautiful. Juicy, sweet, not watery in the slightest. I could eat a whole punnet of those.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Matt Kelty of 26 Seasons. And as you may have guessed, while delicious, the strawberries don't come cheap. But they're still cheaper than jumbo ones being farmed indoors in the US, which at one stage were going for $17 a pop.
We're heading now to a high country station on the upper reaches of the Rakaia River. Glenariff's station is farmed by Mark and Belinda Ensor, who are working with Fish and Game and the High Country Wetland and Waterway Protection Project to protect and realign Glenariff Stream, which runs through their land. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is on a hill above the stream with project manager Steve Terry.
This is one of the key salmon spawning streams in the Rakaia catchment, the Glenariff Stream, and it comprises a few different branches. We're looking at what's known as the east branch in front of us here, and the main stem just slightly out from that. Up against the hill, just where we've come from, there's the south branch, which Mark Ensor's grandfather diverted into the main stem about 70 years ago, to basically put a cutting through, artificial cutting, and diverted all the water into the main stem so that this east branch has a lot less water than it should.
Was that so he could develop this flat land?
It was, and it basically took the water away. It was a much bigger wetland, and so for the last 15 years, having flown these streams and done all the salmon spawning surveys for a number of years, I kept sort of looking at what we could do to enhance the salmon fishery in terms of keeping the salmon in these headwaters. We want the little fish to remain here in these wetland environments for as long as possible. Basically, if they're not sort of a fingerling size, they can't survive in the ocean. So if you're ejecting all the small fish out too early, they just don't survive that ocean transition. So our goal is to keep them in these headwaters until they reach that size so they have a better chance of surviving.
Now, there's quite a bit of land between where we are and the Rakaia River, and it looks like it's quite boggy as well.
It's very boggy. It wants to be a wetland. So this area of land here, Fish and Game, through bequests left to us, we've managed to negotiate purchasing it off Mark, and the goal is to renaturalise the stream so that this becomes a much bigger wetland. And it's a 44 hectares through here that's being retired, and we're putting a Q2 covenant on the lot, or two different covenants on two different blocks, but essentially it's a one big unfenced block. So you see already, now that it hasn't been grazed for 6 or 8 months, it looks vastly different to what his Mark's farmland is, and once we add extra water to it, it'll be quite a significant wetland here. And all the little backwaters and swampy bits are where the juvenile fish tend to want to live, so we're creating that habitat for them.
It's amazing how quickly the reeds and all those water-loving plants grow back.
Yep, they're right. And we've had botanists assess the land before we retired it, and there's a vast number of wetland species that I don't even know what the names of them are, but there's a lot of them out there that are beneficial and sort of all works in the long run.
So this area that Fish and Game is in the process of purchasing has two creeks running through it, and they're quite close to each other, aren't they?
They are. They are very close in places. So they've tried to farm it for a number of years, 70-odd years, and they can't get rid of the rushes. So no matter how hard they try, it just wants to be a wetland. So it's only natural that we do this. So, we've talked about it with Mark for the last 15 years, Mark and Belinda, about diverting the stream, and it wouldn't be a big job to do it just with a digger at the top end, but the reality is once we flood all this land, we have to buy it off and we have to retire it. So that's the only reason we're able to do this, through long-term negotiations.
So basically Mark's grandfather diverted one of the streams we can see so that he could intensify the farming on land that the stream was originally going through, and now you want to block that stream off again and re-divert it back to where it was going before.
Yep, it was an artificial cutting that he created, so we'll effectively just block that off and re-divert the water, re-naturalise it into the stream, the stream bed's still there, it hasn't been filled in, so now it'll have water in it. But we have to put a bridge in because we're now blocking off the access to two properties, so it requires a proper bridge with the consents, and we've managed to find some funding through Ministry for the Environment that are helping us out with this, which without that funding we wouldn't have been able to do it. So essentially the bequest money to buy the land was the seed money to get the project going.
So someone left a lot of money to Fish and Game that is being put to good use.
Yep, the bequest was to help the salmon fishery in the Rekaia and Waimak rivers, and we're doing a bit of work in the Waimak as well, but the bulk of this money is being spent on retiring this block of land to enhance the rearing potential for this stream. And you'll see looking upstream, there are parts we've protected over the last 10 or 15 years, and there's a distinct corridor there that's been fenced off. So there's a number of stations around here that we're sort of doing this sort of work on. But it's going above and beyond what the rules are and making those setbacks. And by and large, when we find the money, and I kind of, talking with the farmers over the years, that's generally how it comes down to. If you can find the money to help them out with the fencing, we tend to go ahead with it.
What impact does fencing off creeks have on spawning salmon?
I guess from a salmon spawning perspective, the adult salmon can spawn in any gravel area, but they don't like silt, because silt, when you spawn, the silt fills in the cavities between the gravels where they lay their eggs, and often causes a fungus to grow on the eggs, and then the eggs don't hatch. So the key is to keep that silt source not in the stream as such, or not regularly being disturbed by stock accesses in the stream. And what you're essentially providing is a lower nutrient water quality that enables the natural algae, which is a thin light algae, to grow on the rocks, which is then food for invertebrates, and that in turn creates the ecosystem for the salmon to feed on them. And they don't tend to spawn in these low springs, but this is the bit we want them to remain. We're basically enhancing or enlarging that rearing capacity.
Fish and Game must be quite excited about this project, because it's not often, I guess, they get to buy land.
No.
Off farmers.
Yeah, thanks to the bequest of Jim McIntyre that this has happened. I think this is the way of the future moving forward. If you can compensate the farmer for retiring their land, then they're a lot more open to doing it. And I think realistically it's their farm. We should be paying some money for it to be retired.
So without that money that Fish and Game received from a bequest, this probably wouldn't have happened.
He wouldn't let us divert the stream, because it essentially floods this 50, 40 hectare block here, and he can't farm it. So, I mean, you can see there's a distinct line where he is farming it to now where he's retired it, and it wants to be a wetland.
Now tell me about the salmon and the journey they go on.
So if we start in the headwaters here, the salmon spawn right at the top of these streams in the pristine gravels. The young lie in the gravel, or the eggs lie in the gravel for a month or so, and then the young ones emerge, and they've still got the yolk sac attached to them, which they grow on in the gravels until they're able to fend for themselves. And they stay in these streams for as long as the ecosystem can support their growth. Then they migrate out to the ocean. They've got to be the size of your, pretty much your finger. They're called fingerlings before they're smoltified, which is a process of enabling them to live in the salt water. And if they don't get to that size and they enter the salt water, they die. So we're trying to keep them in the river on the headwaters as long as possible.
Yes.
So that happens sort of 6 months after they're emerged, and prior to Christmas they'll head out to sea. So the majority, sort of 80% of the population, will come back as three-year-olds starting in sort of November. But once they enter the fresh water, they don't eat. And then they'll spend 2 or 3 months in the river, and they often hole up in the river somewhere, and there can be large numbers in different holes, and then they come up and they pair up from the holes and come up and do their thing, and they spawn.
Somehow they find their way back to the stream where they came from.
That's right. And it's really difficult to do research on these fish other than trap them when they're coming out of these streams and finding out their age and size. And there's also DNA you can do, and each stream will have its own DNA, so we can determine where a fish came from. But once they get to the point where they want to leave the stream, we can't really put radio tags on them because they're too small. So yeah, we don't really know what happens when they go to sea.
There are quite a few paradise ducks around here.
They love water.
Yep.
They love the farmland as well, so it's a great environment for them. They're more seen as a pest for the farmers, but they're an asset to the game bird hunters. So.
Yeah. Now we are heading down the hill towards
the place where you are going to divert the stream back to how it was prior to intensification of this land?
Aesthetically, you could, looking out over that wetland and a mixture of farmland, it does look nice.
I agree. I think it really does add that natural beauty to the landscape, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So this is essentially where the cutting, well, it's 20 metres upstream, but we'll hop out and have a look here at the stream.
I am standing beside the south branch of the Glenariff stream, and it's about, 4 metres across and quite fast flowing, very clear. And Steve's got his waders on. What are you going to do, Steve?
So this is a bathyscope, so it's basically a cone-shaped item that we use to, it's got a glass bottom on it. We have a look at the substrate and the algae growing on the stones, and we've actually got a master's student at Canterbury University doing a study in conjunction with this project, looking at the difference between the previously restored sections of these streams and the developed sections to see what change the land retirement does over time. So I've just started collecting the invertebrate data, and we haven't actually seen any results yet. But
interesting.
Yeah, no, it will be. It's good that they're on board and helping out. So we've got Cawthron on board helping out as well. Environment Canterbury, they're funding all the water quality monitoring work. So I collect the data and they do the analysis.
So do you spend a lot of time out here in your waders?
Once every couple of months I'm up in the stream, and we've got some sites at Manuka Point, some sites at Algidus. We have previously done quite a few sites in the Ashley, in the Waimak, in the Hiranui. Looking at doing some in the Selwyn. We've done some in the Selwyn in the past. But yeah, various catchments. So a lot of these different high country stations have seen me walking around with this orange bathyscope. But it's essentially like putting your head underwater with goggles and having a look at the health of the stream. And because I've been doing it for quite a while now, and you've seen a broad range of different streams, you know what's a healthy stream and what's not. So if you just walk upstream here before I jump in the water.
Luckily, I have got my gumboots on already.
We'll stop here. So this area here, literally the whole stream bed in this area here was one salmon red this season. So two salmon basically dug a hole, which would be 4 metres by 5 metres, and they would have deposited 4,000 or 5,000 eggs in there. They were quite big salmon, the pair. And what this diversion essentially did was put too much water in the main stem from here down, so there was less rearing potential in that stream, and it took all the water out of the other stream, so it meant there's no spawning in that stream or rearing.
Do anglers fish this creek here?
Trout anglers do, so we shut the river off to salmon fishing at Lake Coleridge at the power station, and above that is effectively a salmon sanctuary, so they can rest up before they spawn. But even the trout that live in the stream will predate on the salmon eggs as well, so it's a natural predator.
For those of you who love the sound of running water, I am going to place my microphones by the Glenariff stream here in the high country. Mark and Belinda, or BJ as she's known, turn up and they're covered in mud.
It's been a bit of a difficult morning actually, buddy, getting stuck trying to get some ewes and lambs across a muddy bit of creek. The tractor was just stuck with a load of shingle on the back of it.
How did you get it out?
Well, with BJ's help. Sort of interrupted your time since you've been here.
All good. Now, firstly, can you just tell me about the property here? How long have you been farming, and what's the history of this land?
Oh, so it's a it's a family, well, it's a family-owned farm. My father farmed it before me, and his father as well. And originally it was my great-grandfather that bought next door and these two properties down here. So I was brought up here, and my father was too, with his buddy father, etc.
How special?
Yes. So we've got 850 hectares, and it's a, we're sort of unique that we've only, we've got 350 hectares of cultivatable land. It's relatively small. We run 5,500, 6,000 stock units.
Is it quite a challenge farming here?
It is quite a challenge. It's you just get a lot of extremes from snow to rain, and it's just an hour up a shingle road. It's, everything becomes more difficult for where we live.
Belinda, what's your background?
I'm from a farm, a flatland farm in Sheffield, where you drive to the edge of your paddocks and, you know, look over the bank into a water race. So this is all very different than my my beginnings.
And what's it like living up here?
We're very lucky. We've got a couple of kids that are living the country dream. We've had no school bus for the last 5 weeks, much to their delight. So just little things like that in the high country. It's every day is a bit of an adventure. And yeah, no, it's amazing.
What's happened to the bus?
Oh, well, unfortunately our road with this these things, the land doing what it's want, the road disappeared under a few landslides, and the bus didn't seem to want to come to us for a week or three. So yeah. The kids were very pleased.
Oh, lovely. And so what's happening at the moment on farm?
Well, we are just finishing up winter, and spring is also upon us, which is exciting. It's nice to not be in the mud so much. We're about to start lambing, and we've got some crops to get in, and it'll be time to make bales of hay and silage again soon. So, yeah, it's never ending up here.
And there's still quite a bit of snow on the hills, on the mountains.
Yeah, we hopefully look at the snow for another month or two yet, and then it will all wash down about December. We usually have end of December, there's a big flood, annual flood, and the Rakaia goes bank to bank, and then we'll be looking at blue mountaintops for a month or two.
We are standing beside the Glenariff stream, and this was diverted by your grandfather.
Yeah, when he was running it, he had very limited paddocks, so he only had 30 or 35 hectares of paddocks, and it's just an economic reality of having to develop things, and it's carried on all through my father's generation and through into my generation as well. It's just a slowly evolving thing.
How did you first get involved with the High Country Wetland and Waterway project?
Well, Steve's project's been an ongoing thing for years and years, and we've always talked about it. I've always had the theory that if they come up with enough money, then we can do a deal. And we all knew that it's probably going to be good for the environment, but and good for the salmon, but they finally came up with some money from a request. And this bit down here was still, even though it's been drained, is still relatively wet. But it was a bit that grew in the summer. You couldn't graze it in the winter, but it was good summer grazing.
Yeah, the land definitely wants to do its own thing here, no matter what we're doing on top of it. It's always going to revert, or at least try its very best to, in this case, be a wetland, I think.
As well as being a farmer, Belinda's also the project coordinator for the High Country Wetland and Waterway project.
It's nice to be able to do something a bit different, and Steve definitely brings a lifetime of knowledge on not only the salmon, but all the other little creatures and critters we have in our creeks up here. So, yeah, that's been quite the learning curve.
Are other farmers quite interested in what's happening here on your farm?
Yeah, I think so. There's always interest in projects like this. We hope we're doing the right thing as farmers, and from the High Country Water Project side as well. We're, you know, hoping to do the right thing and create a bit of interest so other people can look to do a bit more of this. We'll get involved as well.
And Steve, for farmers to come on board, there has to be some sort of incentive.
Well, it's got to be. They're farming land, they're making an income off it, and if we think it's of benefit to have it retired, then we've got to compensate them fairly. And I see that as the way of the future, and I'm sure there's money out there for this type of environmental enhancements that'll work. I'm happy to work with any of the farmers, protecting what they'd like to see protected while still not losing their economic farming potentials on those blocks of land. So it's sort of, it's trying to make it work, but you're not going to see the benefits of this for a decade or two before it really recovers. But you've got to look at it in that long-term perspective and try and think ahead.
Steve Terry from the High Country Wetland and Waterway Protection Project. Cosmo was also talking to Mark and Belinda Ensor at Glenariff Station in Canterbury's High Country. And to see some photos from Glenariff, check out the Country Life RNZ webpage. Well, that's it for this week. Have a jolly good weekend. Bye now.
See you next week. Ka kite.